think about this. Oh, this is just a lot of... And all of that kind of stuff stops the flow. It's a very private... It's like every spiritual teacher that I have been blessed to know in my life, you would never recognize. They don't look the part. They don't act the part. They don't dress the part. I had a great teacher at Wayne State University. I think the best professor that I ever had. His name, I don't know if any of you ever had him, his name was Fritz Radl. R-E-D-L. Anybody know that name? Anybody? One, two. Did you have him at the school? Yeah. He was a contemporary of Carl Jung in Austria. A great teacher. And I had him for a doctoral seminar at Wayne State. And you had to put your name in. He would teach a class. Just like on Wednesday evenings. And it's like, I didn't bag groceries ever on Wednesday evenings. Because I was always in Dr. Radl's class. And there would be like 2,000 people in the class. Everybody would sign. Everybody that could, you know, get it. He would come in and give these fabulous. And then he would also have this seminar for doctoral students. And you had to reach a certain level and you had to apply and you had to figure out how to get in. And there would only be 7 or 8 or 10 at the very most who would ever get into this. And each week we would come in and we would present different projects and he would discuss it with us. And he wrote books like, they probably have some of his books here, Controls from Within. Brilliant man, beautiful soul. I don't know if he's still living or not. And he came into class, and this is, he talked about, he was a very close friend of Dr. Maslow. And Maslow did the same thing. He would present to us this little scenario. Tell you, a self-actualizing person, a person who's living at this highest level, comes into a dinner party. And everybody at the dinner party is dressed up in formal attire. Black tie, fancy gowns. And this person shows up dressed like I am today. Pair of sneakers, pair of jeans, and a shirt. Baseball hat. What does he do? And he said, write about this for 15 minutes. And each one of us wrote for 15 minutes, trying to prove that we really had this down, you know. He wouldn't pay attention to it. He wouldn't be bothered by it. He certainly wouldn't change. He wouldn't allow this to be something that would upset him. He wouldn't draw attention. All of this kind of stuff. And we would all write about how this person would act. Just it would ignore it and so on. And Fritz said, in his heavy Viennese accent, he said, none of you got it. You all missed it. He said, the answer is, he wouldn't notice. He wouldn't notice. The people that I am speaking about, and as I speak to you today about this business of that what you desire desires you, that what you want wants you, that what you feel is missing, you can attract into your life. The people who are capable of doing this, the great city teachers, the Christ consciousness livers, are those who don't notice appearances, are in a different world. And don't need to prove anything to anybody else. And they go with that inner conviction and they know. And they're open to it. And they know that there not only are other dimensions of reality available to us, but they know how to not just peer into them and look, but how to enter them and live in those dimensions. And they are very private and you can't find them. They're not available. They live in a sort of shadowy world without any need to prove anything. They're beyond that. And that's something that you have to adopt. Even though you don't have to do it, you don't have to go home and become a secret person and get rid of everybody in your tribe and say, all right, I've had it with all of you, you know. You don't do that. But you take this as a very private matter between you and this divine force that is God. And in order to do it, you have to stop being what is called a cookie thief. You know what a cookie thief is? Here's a poem written by Valerie Cox. called The Cookie Thief. A woman was waiting at an airport one night with several long hours before her flight. She hunted for a book in the airport shop, bought a bag of cookies, and found a place to drop. She was engrossed in her book, but happened to see that the man beside her, as bold as could be, grabbed a cookie or two from the bag between, which she tried to ignore to avoid a scene. She munched cookies and watched the clock as the gutsy cookie thief diminished her stock. She was getting more irritated as the minutes ticked by, thinking, if I wasn't so nice, I'd blacken his eye. With each cookie she took, he took one too. With only one left, she wondered what he'd do. With a smile on his face and a nervous laugh, he took the last cookie and broke it in half. He offered her half as he ate the other. She snatched it from him and thought, oh, brother, this guy has some nerve and he's also rude. Why, he didn't even show any gratitude. She had never known when she had been so galled and sighed with relief when her flight was called. She gathered her belongings and headed to the gate, refusing to look back at the thieving ingrate. She boarded the plane and sank in her seat, then sought her book, which was almost complete. As she reached in her baggage, she gasped with surprise. There was her bag of cookies in front of her eyes. If mine are here, she moaned with despair, then the others were his, and he tried to share. Too late to apologize, she realized with grief that she was the rude one, the ingrate, the thief. Now, all of us are cookie thieves in some capacities in our lives. And we have to really guard against knowing something to be what is the reality. Having that as in our internal world and not being open to other possibilities. And the possibilities that I'm speaking about here involve understanding that the sacred or the divine part of you wants something very different than this ego part of you. There really are two of us in each and every one of us. One, of course, is the ego. And this ego is just an idea. You'll never find it in an autopsy. It's not anything you'll ever experience in the physical world. It's just an idea. And this idea says that who I am is special and important. And who I am is separate. Mostly who I am is separate from. And who I am is absorbed in my self-importance. And who I am is insane. Because insanity is defined as believing that you're something that you're not. And this idea that we carry around of our separateness, it says over and over again that where I leave off is where you begin. And my separateness keeps me without any awareness of my connection to you or to God or to all of the rest of the environment. It's the separation that this idea has. And it is what keeps you in a state of turmoil in your life. It's not bad, it's not evil, it's not wrong. It's just the idea that somehow the tribe has taught you and you have taken on this idea that somehow you and the rest of us and God are separate identities. And then there's another part of you. And this is the sacred part of you. And this sacred part of you, what I call the sacred self, what some call the higher self, only wants one thing. It only wants you to be at peace. It doesn't care if you're right or if you're wrong, if you're good or you're bad, if you get a lot or you get little, how much you have, who you're better than, who you defeat, how old you are, how young you are, what color you are, what sex you are. It is not interested in any of that. That's all the work of the ego, the idea of your separateness and your individualism. This part of you, this sacred higher part of you, only wants you to be at peace. I returned this year from a two-week trip to Australia in the last 2 weeks of June with John Gray. We each did a half-day seminars together, you know. And he talks about us men and women as being not only different from each other, but from different planets, right? Mars and Venus and so on. And he's very good. And he offers a lot of wonderful suggestions for really improving relationships. And then I talked about my theme was your soulmate is the person you can't stand. Now, I want to explain that. Because, you see, there's a lot of you who are not on your path. You know, they're not even on an entrance ramp to your path, right? They're not going to be on your path. They're never going to get on your path, even though you buy books and leave them around and get tapes and put them in their car and set it to the exact place that they need to hear and all of that. They just keep showing up, and you can't get rid of them. And you decide to separate from them, or you get them away from them, and you say, don't call me, and I'm going to change my phone number. And 2 months later, you're right back there with us, like in Waterworld. Remember Waterworld? When Kevin Costner becomes this, he's the guy with the gills and so on, and Dennis Hopper is this guy that, you know, and Kevin Costner just keeps showing up and bothering this guy who's trying to conquer the world or whatever he's doing in Waterworld. And he looks at Kevin Costner and he says, you know, he said, you're like a turd that won't flush. You know, you just keep coming back. You've all had that experience, haven't you? You just go... Still there. Just keeps coming back. Turns, and there it is, right? It's not real metaphysical, but it's a wonderful way of explaining it, you know? And by the way, that divine force is in those turds, too. Don't think it isn't. It's in all things. So, so it's like there are people like this in your life, right? And these people are really, like, in your life, in your face. And you think that they don't belong there, that somehow you'd like to get rid of them. And the truth is that these are your soulmates. Now, people come to me and they say, I finally found my soulmate. Oh, God, this is so wonderful. We both think alike. We both act alike. We both like asparagus. We both we pee at the same time. He goes to say something, and before he's even got it out, I say it. I'm thinking about him, and he calls me on the telephone. We both vote for the same people. We read the same books. We read the same magazines. We like to go to the same movies. We go to bed early. We get up late. This is my soulmate. I say, you got 3 more weeks, maximum, with this thing. Max. You don't want a soulmate. You want a mirror, right? Then enough of looking at what you already are already, you know? I say, your soulmate is the person you can't stand. Or the person that you have difficulty in understanding. See, here's the key. My teacher said very clearly, directly to me, very clearly, Nisargadatta Maharaj, 15 years ago, very clear. Enlightenment is being immersed in and surrounded by peace in your life. Enlightened people, the people that you meet that are truly at that enlightened state, are people who are able to express peace, immersed in it, send it out, receive it back, at all moments in their life. And when someone asks, you know, they've asked me, what's the difference between these highly enlightened people and the rest of us? Is it that they have unconditional love and we don't? I say, no, that's not the difference. We have unconditional love. They have unconditional love. We have that. The difference is that they don't have anything else. That's all they have. So that if you're on a cross being crucified and someone throws a spear into you, out of you comes what's inside. All I have inside is forgiveness, is love. That's all I have. If you're shot in 1948 in India, and your name is Mahatma Gandhi, you say, Krishna, love, and die. Because that's all that's inside. And that's not something that's so alien to us, to be able to be at peace in our lives. It's really all we want. It's all the sacred, the higher part of you wants for you. And, of course, in miracles, there's this wonderful affirmation. If you don't get anything else today, get this one down. All right? It says, in this moment, it says, I can choose peace instead of this. I can choose peace instead of this. What a great reminder. You know? You're just ready to explode, and you stop yourself and say, I can choose peace instead of this. So there are essentially two two paradigms that I need to talk about. I've talked about before at some of the seminars I've done here. I've written about in Your Sacred Self. But in order to be able to understand manifesting, to be able to manifest, you are really understanding this idea that the person in your life who is able to push the buttons that sends you into a frenzy, somebody else could push the same button and you react with love, but that person pushes that button and off you go, and your ego instantly enters into it, and you need to make them wrong. This could be your spouse, this can be an ex-spouse, this can be a lover, this can be one of your children, this can be a mother-in-law, this can be anybody, it can even be a stranger. And they push that button, and you go into a frenzy. What is happening in this moment is that this is a divine master who has showed up in your life that you should be kneeling down and paying homage to and saying, thank you, God, for sending this divine teacher into my life. I know your ego is really having a tough time with that. But what is happening in this moment is, here is someone who is teaching you in this moment that you have not mastered yourself yet. That's what they teach you in this moment. And that is your soulmate. That is the person that you need to be able to send love from a peaceful inner expression that says, I could choose peace instead of this. And when you are in a relationship with that person, and they push the button, and you are able to be at peace, truly at peace, not acting. Now these great spiritual teachers come disguised as manipulative, cunning SOBs very often. And there's only a few of them in the whole planet. But they move around a lot. And they got a lot of disguises. But until you, and the test for you to be able to do this is very, very simple. It's a very simple test. Something you can work on when you leave here today. You can work on it the minute that you walk out of here with that one that won't flush. Who keeps coming back. When you have the choice to be right or to be kind, you pick kind. You pick kind. The higher part of you says, be at peace. When you're at peace, you react with kindness. The ego says, be right. It's much more important to be right. Why do you think I subtitled this book, Making the Decision to Be Free? You are only free when you lose your self-absorption, your sense of separation from those that send you into those frenzies, and your sense of separation from God. Because God is that divine organizing intelligence that is in all things, including this person who is pushing these buttons and keeps showing up. And they come disguised. Very often, when you're a scurvy elephant yourself, you get them back. It's sort of like there's a karmic debt here. I don't know. I'm not quite sure I understand it. But in this karmic payback system, you know, that I've read about, if you're a scurvy elephant yourself, you get back two or three. Well, I got eight, so I must have been really... And I have one that is really the queen. Her name is Serena. And Serena is 11 years old. And she is my divine master. I pay homage to her every day. Thank you, Serena. Thank you for showing up in my life. I follow her around with a pad. I said, come on, say something stupid. Come on, I need material. She said, get out of here. Will you get out of here? The only thing that I made a mistake with Serena, only mistake I've ever made is when we named her, you know. Serena is not appropriate for her. And she's great. I mean, she's like the real test, the great love of my life. But boy, oh boy. I mean, she actually said, you know, there's a rumor that you actually wrote a book about how to raise kids. Is there any truth to that? I want to expose that right away, you know. That's how she talks. It's like, you know, with the leg going up and down and the eyes roll back and the head. I said, you know, you could come to my seminar. I'm giving a seminar right down there. I said, people actually pay to hear me speak. I said, would you like to come? She said, why? I'm like, get a life, you know. And she's giving me advice almost every day on how to be a better parent. What I should be doing, what I'm doing wrong, if I only did it this way. Dad, I'm telling you right now, if you would just listen to me, I really know about this. Okay, I'm 11 years old, I know what I'm talking about. She talks really fast like this and goes on and on. Now just listen, just try this. If you just tried this, if you just did it this way. And finally she's giving me a hard time about something I'm telling her that she has to do, or her mother's telling her. And I said to her finally one day in exasperation, I said, Serena, I said, I want you to stop blaming me for the kind of father that I am, and I want you to start taking responsibility for it yourself. And she looked at me. This is the truth, exactly. She looked at me and she put her leg out like into her posture, you know. She said, you want to run that one by me one more time? I said, you have got to stop blaming me for the... She said, did you just tell me that I should be responsible for the kind of father you are? I said, exactly. That's what I'm saying. She said, I don't get it. I said, well, before you came here, you were in what we call nowhere. N-O-W-H-E-R. You were in the spirit world, in God's loving grasp. And you came here and you had lessons you had to learn. We all have these great lessons and we all have a heroic mission, and there's no mistakes in the whole universe. God doesn't make any mistake. And you had these lessons to learn. And God asked you, what is it? What are these lessons that you have to learn? And you told God exactly what it is that you had to learn. And God said, well, if you want to learn those lessons, then this is the father you need. And you picked me. You said, all right, I'll take him. And you picked Mom. And you chose us to be the people who will help you to learn the lessons that you have to learn in this lifetime. She said, I don't remember any of this. All right? No. I said, your memory is not a good indication of whether what I'm saying is true, all right? You don't remember sleeping in a crib, but you were in a crib for a long time. You don't remember what you dreamt about. You don't remember what you had for breakfast last Thursday. Your memory will deceive you all the time. It is not your memory that you ought to be referring to here. Trust me, I know what I'm speaking about. You chose me and picked me to be in your life, and I'm just doing what I know how to do. So she said, you're then telling me that before I got here, I picked you to be my father. I said, exactly. She said, I must have been in a hurry. I said, when you're making important decisions like this, don't rush through. One of the things I've been telling you all your life, slow down, take your time, don't put... She's great. I'm telling you, she is great. But the greatest scurvy elephant story I ever had from my kids, all of whom teach these great lessons, is my wife went away last October to work on her book about a spiritual approach to childbirth and infancy care, which she's working on completing now. And she has this whole idea that there's too much fear in the process of bringing children into the world, and women are sort of, the tribal consciousness is one in which this is something that you should be afraid of, rather than that you are participating in this miracle, and that you ought to see it that way and program yourself that way and change around your biography. You'll change around your biology, and you'll change around how this experience affects you, and it's very divine and spiritual. She's writing about that, and she's ultimately qualified to do so, having had 7 children. So she went away in October. Now, usually when I go away to write, I always tell her, like, I hear voices, you know, and I said, my voice tells me I got to go away and write. And I go away to the west side of the state, and I live in Florida on the east coast, and I go over to Marco Island, and I write for 5 days, and I come home on the weekends, you know, like a good father and husband. She rented a house on Maui. for the month of October. And she went away to write, and I stayed home. And I didn't have any speaking engagements, and I didn't do any writing or anything like that. I just decided I'll be Mr. Mom. I'll be Dad for and Mom for the whole month. And I had no idea of how many appointments these kids have. I couldn't believe that, you know. It's like, and now when I tell them that I didn't have anybody to drive me anywhere, they just say, yeah, yeah, tell me a little bit more about that, will you, Dad? You know, about how tough it was when you were a kid and all of that. And they have lessons, and they have, I have four different schools that they go to, and they have to be picked up at different times, and they have a piano, and they got the singing, and they got this, and tennis, and horseback riding, whatever. I don't know. There's a thousand different things that they got to do, and where they've got to be, and they got to go shopping, and they got to buy, you know, all kinds of feminine things and so on. I mean, it's just, I got to go take them for all of this stuff. And so I hired three more people to help me out while I was there. Not that I needed them, you understand. I mean, I could handle it, but, so I was, I had taken one, I usually get up around 4 a.m. and run for a couple of hours every day. I've been doing it for a long time. I'm in this program called The Zone, Enter the Zone. And I've been doing that and endorse it and feel very wonderful about it and balancing your intake and exercise and all of that. I've been running for almost, for over 20 years now, every day. I mean, every day. And, so I get up early and I run, and I usually do 10 or 12 miles. And then I come in and, I take one of my daughters to school and I come back and I was making breakfast for them. My wife makes, waffles for them in the morning. So I decided to help out with the waffles. Only she uses this machine and all that. I just use a toaster. It's a whole lot easier. This one. They're frozen. You stick them in there. They don't know the difference. And it's not easy because some like them darker, you know, and some like them lighter. And there's a lot of decisions that have to be made. And I'm having breakfast. I'm making breakfast, and they're behind me at the table behind me, the four of them. Summer, Serena, Sands, and Sage, who all go to this elementary school. And I've got one in pre-K and another one in 8th grade and one in 3rd grade and one in 5th grade and two in college and one in graduate school and one out, all right? So I'm making breakfast and having a good time and I feel great. I've run and I feel terrific and I've balanced all my protein and carbohydrates and I'm feeling terrific. And all of a sudden I hear Summer, my 13-year-old, say to Serena, who's sitting behind her, she said, if you didn't have any feet, would you wear shoes? And Serena looked at her like, you know that. What? What kind of a question is that? Of course not. She said, if I didn't have any feet, would I wear shoes? Of course not. How could I wear shoes? And Summer looked at her and said, well, then, why are you wearing that bra? She said, Oh. I love that story. I mean, I wrote that down. I've never heard anything like that. All of these people who show up in your life, who know how to send you into these frenzies, remember, you have a choice. Now, forget about your children. I mean, these are people that are not going to leave. These are people who are going to continue to show up, and you have a choice. And the choice always is to be right or to be kind. Just start practicing being kind. Just start it. Start it as a program. Just as you're about to react, just as you're about, you see how free you would be. I always tell audiences, imagine you were so free that you didn't have to think about yourself for a whole day. Imagine what that day would be like. How free you would be. If anything that anybody said, and this, I must say, there's a lot of these areas that I work on. Everything I write about comes from my own life experience. I go where I'm sent. I teach what I'm told to teach. I go within and listen to that voice, and I let it come out. And I must say that the thing that I think I have gotten the best at is this business of being in a place where I can be kind rather than right most of the time in my life. And when my wife and I made that commitment to each other that we were going to work at being kind rather than right on the daily little things that you find as irritants in most relationships, if you can just get that out of it, you transform the relationship. And it doesn't take two people to do it. Forget that. The minute that you tell yourself that if I do it but they don't, then it's your ego again saying this doesn't work. How people treat you is their karma. How you react is yours. And so you make that choice. And if that choice to be kind is continually, remove yourself from that relationship. Kindly, with love. But you can literally, almost always transform it. Love is the glue that holds the paradigm. The paradigm of getting out of the tribal consciousness which says being right is more important than being kind. The second and probably toughest one is this business of that I talked about earlier of being willing to be God. Most of us are not willing to be God. And this is a tough one for all of us. And we have to learn this. Probably it's the greatest lesson that we have to learn as we incarnate into our human awareness. This somehow figuring out that who I am is sacred and divine. You see, I think essentially what operates in our universe and what the tribe has taught us is that there are two theories of nature. And one of these theories will allow us to become a manifester and attract to us what it is that we would like to have. And the other prohibits it because it interferes with the flow of the universal force. The first theory of nature says that the universe is a monarchy. And as a monarchy, there is a king. And the king is in charge. And this king, we can call by many names. Call it God. And so God becomes something that is separate from us. We are the subjects of this king, that is the monarch. And because the king is separate from us and better than us, this divine right of kings, remember? Our country was founded on abolishing that kind of a notion. Well, this idea somehow says, this theory of nature, this first theory of nature that I'm presenting here, as the universe as a monarchy, says that who you are is inferior to this God, this monarch. And not only are you inferior to it, but you are, at your core, untrustworthy. Because you are conceived in sin. There's something basically at your core wrong with you. And this theory also says that because you cannot be trusted, you have to rely upon this thing outside of you that you are separate from in order to sustain yourself. Where it came from is very bizarre. It has nothing to do with the spiritual literature. What we are taught by the great spiritual teachers. If you read the New Testament, there's nothing about that in there. But that's sort of what has happened because egos have come along and said, being separate is more important for us to be able to control you if you are thought of as being inferior. Now the problem with this first theory of nature, ladies and gentlemen, the problem with it is that if you subscribe to it, you will always be lost. And most tribes subscribe to it. God is seen as a male, generally a white male, generally a white dead male in heaven. That's how we see it. That's what this theory says. And you will be lost because it says essentially at your core you are not trustworthy because you are separate from that which is divine. And if you are not trustworthy, and you just determine that you're not trustworthy, you can't even trust in your untrustworthiness. Because it's coming from, act upon, when you basically get down to where is this coming from, it is coming from an untrustworthy source. So you can never ever actualize yourself. And you can never ever be divine, nor can you ever become a manifester, or do, as Jesus said, all that I have done and even greater things. You can't do that if you subscribe to this theory of God as the boss. And the only one who really knows is the boss's son. And the boss's son is different from you. You are not the boss's son. All right? That's one. Second theory of nature says that God is not a dead white male in heaven, but that God is a universal intelligence that flows through all things, and at its core it is love, and it does not judge, and it is everywhere, and it is available, and it is inexhaustible, and it does not born, and it does not die. It is eternal. When Lao Tzu, the great author of the Tao, when Jesus, when Buddha, when Zoroaster, when all of the great spiritual teachers, Muhammad, all came down the road and were asked the same question. The question was, what is real, Master? What is real? They all responded with the same answer. That is real, which never changes. Which never changes. So what you're looking for is the part of you that is eternal, that never changes. When I finished writing Manifest Your Destiny and these nine spiritual principles, and I must say, it was very much like being back at Pershing High School. I sat down with my connection to God and my feeling of what I wanted to write about, the tape that Guruji had sent me, having done this manifesting for several months now, and knowing that I wanted to write these principles and to keep them clean and clear and concise with no extras in it at all, tight as could possibly be, and I didn't know how many there were or which one would follow which. And as I meditated and allowed it to flow and allowed it to flow and just surrendered, it all became very clear. It seems to me that there are really four pathways to mastery of anything in our life. The lowest, or the first pathway, is called the pathway of discipline. If you want to go out and learn to hit a tennis ball, you just go out and you hit it and you hit it and you hit it and you hit it and you hit it, and you just practice, practice, practice. If you want to learn how to hit a golf ball, if you want to learn how to dance the Macarena, if you, whatever it is that you want to learn to do, you go out there and you have discipline. All right? Then the second pathway is called the pathway of wisdom. And this is where you now begin to apply the intellect to the discipline, which is what we do in school. We stop. It's only the second pathway, but we think that we're educated when we have the discipline and we have the wisdom that goes with it. Now you learn how to put topspin, now you learn how to slice this, now you learn how to hit an overhead, how to hit a lob, how to hit a drop shot, how to plan your strategy, how to get your opponent out of position, how to do all of the things that it takes to win at tennis or at golf or at dancing or at playing the piano or whatever it is that you're learning to do, including spiritual awareness. That's the second path. But there are a couple of other pathways as well, and I'll share with you what they are as this afternoon unfolds. But this idea of thinking that just because I have discipline and wisdom that I now have mastery is absurd, and it's where schools almost always stop, because you've got to go way beyond just applying your intellect and applying your discipline. You have to move into another dimension, if you will, and understand what is called the third and fourth pathways to mastery, which I'll talk about very, very shortly. So when I sat down and did this, I had the discipline and I had the wisdom, but I didn't have what else it took until I was able to meditate and go within and discover it. And the way that I want to present this business of being willing to be God is, as I've often said, I think of God as like the ocean. And I think of myself as like a glass. And I take this glass and I dip it into the ocean. And when I dip the glass into the ocean, I ask myself, what do I have here? And what I have, of course, is a glass of God. And it's not as big, and it's not as strong, and it's not as omnipotent and not as omniscient, perhaps, but it is still God. And just like a wave on the ocean is what the ocean is doing, you are what God is doing. We have to know this. And if you take a drop of water out of the ocean and you put it over here and you say, okay, this is a piece of God, but it is separate from this ocean, what can it do? It just disappears, doesn't it? It just dissipates. It has no strength. It cannot accomplish anything that the ocean can't sustain life, this little drop of water. In order for it to sustain life, it has to be connected to, not separate from, its source, doesn't it? And so the same is true of us. As long as we are in ego minds which convince us that we are separate from this, that first theory of nature that I've just described, as long as we see ourselves over here, and we do, because the tribe has taught us this, because thinking of yourself as God is perhaps the greatest criticism we can give to you. When in fact, if you don't understand that you are divine, and that you are connected to, you are a piece of God, you are what God is doing, and that's the teaching that most of us have failed to grasp or failed to understand. When I finished writing, I did these principles one right after the other, and it took me about, 2 months or so, January and February, going home on the weekends and so on. But it was like, and I would just write, and it was this powerful force, this energy, being in awe, just being in awe of what was coming through me, that I could actually write the principles for manifesting. And I was like, who am I to be writing that kind of thing? And then stopping that and saying, just let it come. Just let it come. It's working. It's working in your life, and you are going where you're sent. And you have this teacher that sent you this tape and wrote to you and encouraged you to do this. This is all being done for a purpose. And get your ego out of it. Get your ego out of it, which is what I did all morning this morning in my meditation. I asked the question, how may I serve? How may I serve these people? And I let go of my exhaustion and my all of that stuff. I remember reading Siddhartha and going through the process he was going through of his awakening when he discovered suffering. This was the story of Buddha as a young man, and he had been fasting. And he had been fasting for something like 50 days. And his friend Govinda finally said to him one day, he said, Siddhartha, he said, what good is fasting? And Siddhartha replied with one of the great responses in all of literature, I can laugh at hunger. He was making a distinction between that which was hungry and that which was laughing at it.
This concludes Side